You're listening to The Monocle Daily, first broadcast on the 6th of July 2017 on Monocle 24. The Monocle Daily, in association with UBS. Hello from Midori House in London and welcome to the Monocle Daily here on Monocle 24 with me, Paul Osborne. Coming up in the programme, Donald Trump steps up the pressure on North Korea.
We'll just take a look at what happens over the coming weeks and months with respect to North Korea. It's a shame that they're behaving this way, but they are behaving in a very, very dangerous manner, and something will have to be done about it.
But what exactly? More talking or military action? We'll discuss the options. In the UK, businesses hope they are finally getting a chance to have their say on Brexit, but has it come too late? Later, how California's governor's leading the opposition to the White House's stance on global warming.
Trump is not hurting the cause of climate change. He's giving it new life and vitality, because his denial, his statement that climate change is a hoax, is so absurd.
Plus, how did an arts and crafts retailer end up smuggling Iraqi artifacts into the US? We'll also go on a culinary tour of Stockholm and talk fashion too, all in the next hour on The Monocle Daily, live from London on Monocle 24. So all that to come, but first a quick look at some of the day's other top news stories. There have been clashes between police and protesters in the German city of Hamburg ahead of the G20 summit in the city. At least one person was seriously hurt in violence which came after police charged a group of anti-capitalist demonstrators. They fired water cannon and pepper spray at the crowd, who responded with bottles, stones and flares. The EU has formally agreed a free trade deal with Japan. It paves the way for trade without tariffs between two of the world's largest economic areas, but details of the deal remain unknown and a final agreement could still be some time away. Nine leading human rights activists have been arrested in Turkey. Among them is the local director of Amnesty International, which has called the arrests a grotesque abuse of power. Turkey remains under a state of emergency imposed after the failed coup against the president Tayyip Erdogan more than a year ago. Since then, more than 50,000 people have been jailed. And France has announced it will ban cars running on petrol or diesel from 2040. The country says its ban on fossil fuel vehicles is a revolution and is evidence of the continued commitment to the Paris climate deal. At present, hybrid cars make up just 3.5% of the French market, and a little over 1% of cars are fully electric. Welcome to the Monocle Daily with me, Paul Osborne. Now, Donald Trump spent much of today in Poland, but it was events in Pyongyang that dominated his day. The US president has warned of pretty severe consequences for North Korea after its latest long-range missile test. This after America's ambassador at the UN warned of the risk of military action. Mr. Trump said something will have to be done about the regime's continuing and advancing nuclear program. But what does that mean? Are the diplomatic options beginning to run out? Well, let's explore that now with John Everard, who is a former UK ambassador to North Korea, among other countries. John, we have been here before. North Korea tests a missile. The United States condemns the test. That's a pattern. But this feels, and the potential scope of the missile, makes it feel like it's more significant this time.
It's different in two ways. Firstly, as you say, the missile is different. It's a much longer range missile. It's an ICBM, as Tillerson admitted just the other day, so that the North Koreans now have a delivery vehicle capable of reaching Alaska, if not yet the western seaboard of the United States. That's one point. The second is that it's the first test since Donald Trump formally gave up on China. Remember the famous tweet that China really tried, but it didn't work, or was that effect? And he's now calling again for China. Remember his tweet asking them to make a heavy move on North Korea. But I don't think in his heart of heart he any longer believes that China is going to sort this out for him, which raises, of course, the huge and difficult question: if China isn't going to bring North Korea to its senses, what then is America going to do?
Britain, again, was another country that was calling on China today, the foreign secretary saying that China needs to exert its influence over North Korea. And as luck would have it, all of these leaders are going to be meeting in Hamburg. So Donald Trump comes face to face with the Chinese president, with the Russian president. I mean, is there any prospect at all that they'll be able to agree some sort of common action plan?
Miracles happen, but it would take a miracle for that to come about. Essentially, the Chinese are in no mood to do anything that might destabilize the Korean Peninsula. They don't want to do so at the best of times, and these are not the best of times for China. There are all kinds of other issues that the leadership are very worried about. And, of course, we have the 19th Party Congress coming up in a few months' time. China's overriding objective is to maintain stability in its immediate vicinity, and you cannot maintain stability by leading on North Korea to the extent that the world is demanding.
Now, you say that the last thing the Chinese want is instability on the Korean Peninsula, but left to his own devices, do they have confidence that Donald Trump, without their interference or influence on North Korea, that Donald Trump won't intervene more directly in North Korea?
This is a great Chinese headache. The fear is that if you do nothing, then the Americans may do something, and that something may actually land you up in a worse position, from Beijing's point of view, this is, than if you had actually got along with the American plan in the first place. But so far, the Chinese, after all, this is not the first time that the Americans have come along to Xi Jinping and asked for help. The Chinese seem to have calculated that the risks of America actually starting a war are less than the risks to them of destabilizing Pyongyang.
Now, this all depends on who's in the room with Donald Trump when these conversations are happening. So this weekend, he's with other world leaders. He'll get a more rounded view of their attitudes to North Korea. But on his own, in the Oval Office, is there a confidence in other countries that the people in the room with him are able to guide him appropriately?
I don't think there's much evidence for that, is there? I mean, if we can look beyond just the realm of foreign affairs to see Trump's behaviour more generally, and he appears to be really difficult to guide, even by people who are used to dealing with difficult presidents. So I think the answer to your question has to be no.
The most senior American general in South Korea has said this week that it's self-restraint that is the only thing that is keeping the US and South Korea from war at this stage. But is there a fear that that kind of talk, that Donald Trump's slightly bellicose rhetoric, could box America into a position where they end up committing themselves to military action, even though there are many people inside Washington who might think that's a bad idea?
Firstly, I'm not sure that Donald Trump worries that much about what many people in Washington might think. He appears to take his own counsel, or at least that of a very small coterie of advisers. Is there a risk that America boxes itself in? Yes, I think there is. And I think that we are already well on the way to that. Nikki Haley, the US ambassador to the United Nations, remarks to the Security Council just yesterday, wasn't it, that if necessary, the United States would use its considerable military assets, was a very big step in that direction. Notice, incidentally, not even a nod to international law. Countries are not supposed to go around threatening war on each other. Self-defense, fine, but not the kind of aggression that she was talking about. So there goes the Security Council and the UN Charter for you. But it seems to me that at some level, the Trump administration is calculating that this is going to end up in a fight anyway. And that if you are going to have a fight, better to have it sooner rather than later. Have it before Kim Jong-un finally develops his long-range nuclear capabilities.
North Korea, of course, has an enormous conventional military poised on the border and has always said that should any aggressive action be taken against it, the first thing it will do is obliterate Seoul.
Sea of fire in the phrase. Yes, that's right. It's the North Korean conventional military has been heavily downgraded and degraded, largely by the sucking of resources away from it and into the nuclear program. It has specifically a lot of artillery, and artillery in the broader sense, a lot of the artillery pieces are in fact missile batteries, are aimed at Seoul. And even with North Korean levels of technology, if you're firing at a target the size of Seoul, you're not going to miss. And it could do immense damage before those batteries are rubbled by airstrikes, battery suppression fire, whatever. That is a big thing. The other big non-nuclear weapon it has is nerve gas. We saw in the case of Kim Jong-nam that North Korea is quite prepared to use nerve gas where it feels it's is to its advantage. I don't think the North Korean leadership would blink before using it in combat.
And again, that leads you back to that question of the people in the room with Donald Trump, that while on paper any military conflict between the United States and North Korea is only going to end one way, in the meantime, there are a lot of people who are going to lose their lives when the battle happens?
Way back when the United States was last considering military intervention in North Korea, people calculated about 1 to 1.5 megadeath to 1 million to 1.5 million deaths. So massively more than any of the casualty figures we've seen in Syria, Iraq, Afghanistan, or all those countries combined. I mean, this, it would be war of a simply a different magnitude. How would it end? It wouldn't be a quick war. It would probably be quite straightforward to take Pyongyang and the other big urban centres in North Korea. But the North Koreans have got extensive bunker systems and tunnel systems. Think Tora Bora on a massive scale, into which they will be heavily dug in. And I think there's a real risk that the North Korean military would fight to the bitter end.
You said earlier that this test, the fact that it was an intercontinental long-range missile, that it was potentially capable of reaching Alaska, changes the dynamic somewhat. But do we know how successful the test was? Because while they obviously weren't aiming to get it to Alaska, it did fall into the sea. So do we know that it's as advanced as we fear it may be?
We can't be 100% sure. It was, in the jargon, it was lofted. That's to say, they fired it straight up rather than at the angle that you would need to fire it at to reach Alaska or anywhere in that direction. It's the kind of question you need to put to a missile expert. But the missile experts appear to be saying that, yes, this was the real deal, and that if the North Koreans had simply ratcheted down their launch pad a little bit, fired at a different angle, then yes, it could reach Alaska.
John, for the moment, thank you very much. Though you'll be back a little later in the programme to take a look at some other stories from across Asia.
I can hardly wait.
John Everard, thanks very much. You're listening to Monocle 24. Now, next today brought another warning to the UK from the European Union's chief Brexit negotiator. Michel Barnier said that London had to get past the idea that it could leave the EU but somehow retain all of the benefits of being inside the single market. That is one of the biggest fears of many business leaders in Britain, but until now some have felt they've been shut out of the government's preparations for Brexit. That could change after last month's indecisive general election result. But could it be too late to stop the exodus of finance firms that so many people have said is now inevitable? Well, let's learn more from Ryan Heath, who is senior EU correspondent at Politico and is on the line now. Ryan, thanks for joining us. One of the first things that Theresa May did when she became Prime Minister last year was scrap a business advisory group that David Cameron had set up. She appears now to have been convinced that was a mistake.
Indeed, and I don't think it's just the high end of the business world. It's not just the finance community that the UK should be worried about. I think it's really across the board. UK is a very open economy. That's been the value of it for hundreds of years. Now, obviously, that ebbs and flows, but the point is that the UK has been able to depend on its Commonwealth, formerly its empire. It's obviously benefited from having many different people coming in from the new EU member states, and that comes with its own tensions, but the point is there's a big degree of integration of these foreign workers into the UK labour force. So if you're going to suddenly cut that off, or if you're going to suddenly stop listening to the voices that represent the companies or the people that fill that gap in the UK labour market, then you're going to deliver yourself an economic shock. And I think that's the scenario that the UK is waking up to. And whether that filters into opinion polls or whether it's really the number one concern of Downing Street, that's not the point. The point is, more generally, there is an awakening that you can't just turn off that tap of workers and think that there isn't an economic side effect.
I suppose the issue, as you say, is how much impact that will now have in Downing Street. There is this meeting tomorrow of around 20 business leaders and proposals for more regular contact for business to have a say on Brexit. But how likely is it that they will actually be able to persuade the government to soften their plans?
Well, that's question number one. And question number two is whether Theresa May is even able to act on their concerns, even if she ends up agreeing with them. Because the problem that Theresa May now faces is that managing some kind of softer Brexit, where you really do try to stay in the single market, or where you do try and alleviate the blow that comes with leaving all of these arrangements that the UK is in now, takes a lot longer to negotiate that sort of arrangement. A clean break is simpler to negotiate, even if it does deliver more pain when it happens. So Theresa May, if she is to listen to these concerns, is going to make her own life more difficult. And I think that's the challenge that she'll now face. She might have actually painted herself into a corner. And even if she can give a few concessions here and there, she's probably stuck now with this quite harsh form of Brexit that she originally outlined.
Now, one of the concerns that many people have expressed is that advice from outside the government doesn't necessarily get to Theresa May, that the ministers, the advisers around her decide what she is told. And that certainly seemed to be a problem in the Downing Street arrangement before the general election. Some of those advisers have now left. But still, unless she personally meets these business leaders and hears what they're thinking, we can't really be certain that their representations will reach the top.
Absolutely. I think there's two themes or factors that are at play here. Number one is that Theresa May was really trying before the election to find a way to shut out Jeremy Corbyn, to shut down any form of sympathy for a social democratic or left-wing viewpoint in the UK. And that was quite a clever tactical move in the sense that if she could promote this sort of one nation form of Toryism that recognised people's concerns about globalisation, that somehow tied it into this Brexit narrative of keeping a tighter control of the borders and so on, then she was really going to be able to lock up a big electoral system for herself. Like, she was going to be able to deliver a very, very big win and secure a Tory majority for a very long time. So it made a lot of sense at one level. But the problem that she faces as a prime minister, and it is a little bit like what Gordon Brown faced, and I worked in the UK Cabinet Office and for the UK Treasury at the end of the Blair era and as Brown was coming in, so I sort of witnessed this firsthand, is Gordon Brown was not very good at thinking out of his immediate environment. Tony Blair was much better at coping with that massive influx of problems and dramas that come at you from 20 or 30 angles at once when you're the Prime Minister. And Theresa May has just been sitting in this mode of dealing with one set of problems in the Home Office, and she hasn't adjusted very well to this massive influx of problems that now come at her in Downing Street. And I think that's where she's finding it a little bit difficult. Her strategy worked when she can control the environment, and Downing Street isn't an environment that you can control very easily.
Just thinking about it from the EU perspective, how are they handling this lack of clarity in Britain after the election? Because it seemed that what Michel Barnier was doing today with that warning about the single market and the implications of leaving was to hand out a sort of a reality check and say, people in Britain, you think that you can have everything that you have now outside the single market. You need to get over that idea because it isn't an option. But politicians, and not just Theresa May, politicians on all sides of British politics have allowed voters to believe that they can have this kind of painless departure from the EU and all the advantages of EU membership and just none of the things they don't like.
Indeed, and it's a little bit of a culture shock for people in Brussels, because I think in this quite small community where everyone knows each other, it's a very well-educated, well-integrated community where you kind of assume you're on the same page as each other. Even if there are slight differences of opinion, you kind of think, okay, we have roughly the same starting point for our discussion. Usually in that environment, you tell people once, maybe maximum twice, some inconvenient fact, and usually that's absorbed to some significant degree. And I don't think that's the case here, because it's such an emotional debate. The UK is in such a different starting place to most of the people in Brussels. So it's very unusual for these Brussels officials to have to say something 5 or 6 or 7 times for the message to sink in. But that's what's happening now. And they kind of waver between this kind of shrug of why don't these Brits get it, to kind of being a little bit paternalistic and talking like the kindergarten teacher and saying, well, let me spell it out to you slowly. Once again, you can't have what you want off the menu. You know, you have to make some difficult compromises. So I think Michel Barnier is in that point now where he kind of is gritting his teeth and saying, well, I've already told you 3 times, but I'll grit my teeth and say it a 4th time and maybe you'll listen this time around. There are just certain things that have to happen in the system, and if you don't like it, then you have to give up the benefits of that system.
Ryan Heath from Politico, thank you very much for your time this evening. You're listening to Monocle 24. Still to come on The Daily this evening, how the devoutly Christian Hobby Lobby ended up smuggling Iraqi artefacts into the US. Plus culinary highlights from Stockholm. And in just a moment, the continuing backlash to Donald Trump's stance on climate change. Do stay with us.
UBS has over 900 investment analysts from over 100 different countries.
Over 900 of the sharpest minds and freshest thinkers in the world of finance today.
No one has more. No one knows more.
To find out how we could help you,
contact us at ubs.com.
Summer is officially here, and so is Monocle's bumper July-August double issue. Here we celebrate quality of life and reveal this year's rundown of the top 25 cities to live in worldwide. We also meet the people striving to make life in their cities better from the mayor of Los Angeles to the sunny team that looks after Tokyo's parks and gardens, to the urban heroes giving back to their hometowns. Meanwhile, in design, we cast our gaze up to the rooftops in Milan and find a hidden and surprisingly verdant world above the fray. And of course, we've always got room for a bit of pure hedonism as we dance the night away in Tel Aviv, unwind in Finland's most inviting and steamiest company retreats, and tuck into some sun-kissed beach food in Valencia. And speaking of sun-kissed, we also sit down with Mario Testino for his hypothetical last meal. That's all in the July-August issue of Monocle, on newsstands everywhere now. Or head to monocle.com to become a subscriber.
Now, we already knew that California was at the heart of the movement to resisting Donald Trump's presidency. But on the specific issue of climate change, the fight back is being led by that state's governor. On the eve of the G20 summit in Hamburg, Jerry Brown's appearing via video link at an event where he is inviting the world to a climate action summit in San Francisco. He says Donald Trump, who is pulling the US out of the Paris Climate Change Accord, doesn't speak for America. Well, for more on this, I'm joined now by Dan Illich from the Fusion Network. Dan, what do we know about Jerry Brown's climate action summit?
Well, have you ever been to a website that just got set up 10 minutes ago? Well, it's a bit like that. There's not much on that website currently. All I can tell you about the actual summit itself is that it is going to be around September 2018, which is a couple of months before COP24, which is, of course, the huge climate change conference where the world does meaningful work on climate, which is going to be held in Katowice in Poland in December next year. So this is going to be in the lead up to that. So currently, Jerry Brown has put a stake in the ground and said, you know what, we're going to wave the flag for California. We're going to have a summit before the main game, before the main conference of parties in Poland, just to show people that, A, California is serious, but also states and regions around the world are also serious. So it appears to be a bit of nothing at the moment, but we'll kind of see what that conference will be. I'm sure in a few months when they get going with organizing it.
Now he has said, you know, this is not about provoking Donald Trump, but he makes this statement to a conference in Hamburg hours before the president turns up for a summit there. That does look quite provocative.
I think, look, Paul, everyone in America is suffering relevance depression syndrome. So when it comes to trying to get the spotlight, so anyone who attacks Donald Trump will be looked upon favorably. And I think Jerry Brown, his approval ratings really show that. So he's already had a couple of cracks at Donald Trump and his environmental policies over the last couple of months. And his approval ratings are sky high. They're at 63%. And he's not even running for office. He can't even run for office again in 2018. So,
well, he can't run to be governor of California again. But, of course, he could go for another job, say, the White House.
That's correct. That's correct, Paul. So it's a, and would you believe, Paul, that he has $24 million locked up in a war chest from his last election that he hasn't even used yet? So in terms of positioning himself as someone who might be able to stand up to Donald Trump and show global leadership, he's really putting himself forward there. So I think this is more of an ego play from Jerry Brown than anything substantial. The Global Summit appears to be, it looks like it's kind of hastily put together to coincide with the G20. But I hope, you know, I hope it is something meaningful. And I think what Jerry Brown's leadership on climate issues has been, his track record is really solid. He's part of many groups, including the Conference of Change Parties. He's the special advisor for the states and regions for COP23 and COP24. He's created the US Climate Alliance, which is 13 states within the USA who are planning on exceeding the Paris Climate Accord, the targets in the Paris Climate Accord. And he's also started another coalition called the Under 2 Coalition, which is a pact among cities and states and countries from all around the world who are trying to limit the global temperature increase to below 2 degrees Celsius. So, you know, he does have a great track record of fighting for the environment. So this is kind of, I guess, partly him positioning himself for 2020. But I don't know. I don't think it's anything truly meaningful at this point. The Global Climate Action Summit is really just a precursor to COP24 in Poland, and I think he's just trying to keep the American ball in play.
And as you say, he's one of a number of state governors and mayors who said that they still want to try and impose action to limit emissions, even though Trump says he wants to pull America out of the climate accord. Presumably that is a kind of a holding pattern in the hope that there will be another president more amenable to action on climate change by 2021.
Yeah, I think that's a good strategy. Though you have to keep in mind, California is a huge state. It is the sixth largest economy in the world. It's bigger than France. So what we're talking about here is a serious... If California was a country, it would be a serious player at the table. It probably should be at the G20 when it comes down to it. So it's... they're not mucking around, and with those 13 other states behind them, I think they will be a real effective force in climate action in the USA.
Dan, thank you very much. Dan Illich there from the Fusion Network. You're listening to The Daily from Monocle 24. Now, next to the US, and specifically to Hobby Lobby, the arts and craft retail chain, which appears to have moved into a slightly different line of trade. According to the US attorney in Brooklyn, it's been caught importing smuggled Iraqi antiquities worth millions of dollars. The attorney says the company has paid $3 million to settle the case and been forced to hand over thousands of artifacts, which is all rather embarrassing for any company, but in particular for one that insists it is run on strict moral Christian principles. Well, let's get more on this now from Monocle's bureau chief in New York, Ed Stocker. Ed, people outside America might not know that much about Hobby Lobby, but it's one of those big out-of-town box stores that you go to do make your own cards and scrapbooking and all these things that people do to fill time that I've never understood how they have. How do you get into the kind of Indiana Jones-style business of smuggling artifacts in from Iraq?
Indeed, yeah, it is a kind of boxy, as you say, fairly ugly sort of chain that started off life in Oklahoma City in the 70s and has since kind of expanded to much of the country. I mean, the owners, this is a family-owned business still. The owners are evangelical Christians, and I think we'll probably talk a bit more about that and the Supreme Court a little later. But then, you know, they've always shown an interest in the Middle East due to their faith. And this goes back to 2009. They basically began to assemble a collection of cultural artifacts. Now, they assembled 5,500 of these that they bought... that made their way from Israel and United Arab Emirates. The point being that they were mislabeled when they came into the US. Their origin was labeled as being from Turkey. They were mislabeled as to what they were. And despite the fact that the president of the company traveled out to the UAE to inspect a large number of these tablets, and the fact that they hired an expert on cultural property law who warned the company that the artifacts may have been looted from historical sites in Iraq, they decided not to listen to that. And they spent over $1 million, in fact, over $1.6 million US in December 2010. They never actually met the dealer they bought them from, and the payments, to make it sound even murkier, were made into seven separate bank accounts. The case, the prosecution here, saying that several clear red flags were raised in the purchase of the artifacts, and yet Hobby Lobby didn't do anything about that, which is why we're now seeing this this fine of $3 million, which you could argue is fairly light, and the fact that they also have to return all of those pieces so that the Iraqi government can make sure they're returned to where they're meant to be.
Now, you mentioned earlier that it's a family-run business, and one that is based on what it says is based on principles of Christianity. And indeed, they went to court 3 years ago to defend these Christian principles, the moral code under which the firm was run. So I mean, this is kind of doubly embarrassing, isn't it?
I mean, you could say that, yes. I mean, just to talk about that case, because it's kind of bizarre and incredible, really. This is not just any court. This is the Supreme Court, and it was a landmark ruling. I mean, the actual court was fairly split in the end. It was 5-4, the decision. But basically, yes, the Christian owners of Hobby Lobby, led by the president, Steve Green, basically objected to having to pay health insurance that included basically family planning or contraception included in that. And the Supreme Court ruled in the favor, basically saying that family-owned corporations don't have to pay for insurance coverage that includes contraception under the Affordable Care Act. It was a huge decision at the time because it obviously meant that, you know, certain companies got out of their obligation to pay for health insurance for employees. So obviously, this company back in the limelight won, as you said before, the first time standing for its principles, now being exposed perhaps as having slightly shadier principles, although obviously the company itself releasing a statement saying that it's complied and gone along with the investigations throughout the whole process, and that it obviously had no knowledge of these artifacts being of Iraqi origin.
So was it just the owners were just collecting them? I mean, I know a lot of them were religious artifacts, were old Bibles and things like this. Were they just collecting them because of their Christian beliefs, or what were they planning to do with them?
I don't actually know whether they were collecting them for a personal collection or if they were to be resold. But the family that owns Hobby Lobby has got a strong interest in collecting religious items from the Holy Land, if you like. And this was part of that. You know, they were interested in acquiring ancient artifacts, and they believed, as they said in their statement, that they didn't come from any dubious origins, and they were, in fact, from elsewhere. What they intended to do with them, I guess we won't know, as they now have to return them all to Iraq, where they came from.
Ed, thanks very much. That's Monocle's New York Bureau Chief, Ed Stocker. You're with The Daily from Monocle 24. Now, this week's edition of our food and drink show, The Menu, takes us to Stockholm, which is also where this week's Food Neighbourhoods, which is the podcast-only spin-off from The Menu, has headed as well. Our guide, Monocle's correspondent, Elna Nekinen Andersson, who took Monocle's Marcus Hippie to the affluent Östermalm neighbourhood of the Swedish capital.
So Östermalm is like the upscale neighbourhood of Stockholm, sort of manicured gardens and well-dressed people and nice boutiques and delis and restaurants and so on. So it's a very sort of comfortable, nice area, high class and a little bit maybe higher in price as well.
What is the plan for this day? What are you going to show to us?
So now we're standing on Östermalm's torg and just next to the food hall. And we're standing next to the temporary food hall because the original one is being renovated. And this is really like a legendary place when it comes to food in Stockholm. It's this old red brick building from the probably late 1800s, I'd say. So it's been closed now for like a year or so, and it's going to be reopened next year, better and brighter.
It's called Östermalm Saluhall in Swedish, and actually this temporary construction next door is really impressive as well. Shall we go in?
Yes, let's do that.
Elna, when you come here to do your shopping, what are some of your favorite spots?
I like to go, for instance, to Melanders Fisk here, which is also an old sort of established fishmonger, fish store here in Stockholm. And they do, you get fresh fish, but also like ready-made food to buy with you. And a classic would be to come here like Friday afternoon after work and get a nice meal for your family. Maybe get some Kalix caviar, which is a sort of unique product from northern Sweden. You eat that on a, like a toast with sour cream and red onion. It's delicious. Or you could get some, if you just feeling like not cooking at all, you could get some like lax burgers, salmon burgers or something like that.
That all sounds so good. And what's also very striking in this place is the presentation. I can see that all these entrepreneurs over here, all these shops are doing their best to, you know, make everything look really nice.
Yeah, it's really beautiful. The Swedes are very good at that. They're also very good at cookbooks, and it's kind of like the same thing here. Everything's just displayed so that you can see everything directly, and it looks delicious, and you just want to buy everything.
I notice a pattern, by the way, in Helsinki, in Finland, for example, there's one or two similar market halls that are under renovation or have been just recently renovated. I reckon these places probably are quite important in supporting small entrepreneurs.
Yeah, I mean, it's kind of a place to, I guess, highlight, you know, food culture and the fact that food can also be a little bit more expensive when it's good quality. It's the opposite of something like, you know, your supermarket where you just, you know, have those microwave dinners or something like that. People that come here appreciate food and they're also prepared to pay a little bit more.
And these places are also great in showcasing what a country has to offer in terms of food. What else would you like to show me over here, by the way? What else is going on over here?
I like the fresh produce here, like the fresh vegetables and berries and so on, which, you know, are from the vicinity here, close by here in Stockholm, and you don't always find that. What's interesting about fish in Stockholm is that you always have to like ask where is this coming from, because sometimes it's from Gothenburg, which is the common thing, because here the waters have been kind of polluted a little bit, so you have to be careful not to eat too much like Stockholm fish. But on the other hand, it's nice to support your fishermen in that live close by and so on.
So what's your conclusion? How often do you go for Stockholm fish and how often for Gothenburg fish?
Well, Stockholm fish maybe like couple of times a month or something. There's only certain places that sell it, not everyone, so you have to ask. But it also, it feels like kind of strange that the fish would, you know, travel that far, because it's from Gothenburg here, it's like 5 hours drive.
It's a long way to go. One more place, by the way, I want to see. There is a place that sells moose burgers.
Moose burgers, yes, exactly. And moose burgers are delicious, and you can also get like moose balls, you know, just like meatballs out of moose meat. It's really, really nice sort of game taste to it.
So how often do people eat that? It's a bit like in Finland, people always talk about eating bear, but they rarely do. How often do you find yourself eating moose?
Yeah, not very often, but it's also depends on maybe like if you hunter. In a family like that, they might have, you know, a little bit of moose in their freezer, and then it's easy. But I don't have any you know friends who do that, so the only time I eat it if I come here and get some.
And that's Monocle's Elna Nekkinen Anderson touring Stockholm's district there with Marcus Hippie. You can get more from that in this week's edition of The Menu. It premieres Friday at 1900 London time here on Monocle 24. Still to come, though, on the Monocle Daily, we'll be talking fashion before the end of the programme. And in just a moment, we'll take a look at some of the big stories across Asia. Do stay with us.
UBS is a global financial services firm with over 150 years of heritage, built on the unique dedication of our people. We bring fresh thinking and perspective to our work, and we know that it takes a marriage of intelligence and heart to create lasting value for our clients. It's about having the right ideas, of course, but also about having one of the most accomplished systems and an unrivaled network of global experts. That's why at UBS, we pride ourselves on thinking smarter to make a real difference. Tune in weekly to The Bulletin with UBS for all the latest insights and opinions from UBS and experts from around the world.
On Meet the Writers this week, join me, Georgina Godwin, as I talk to Daniel Kalman, the German author who's sold more at home than Dan Brown and J.K. Rowling. The award-winning writer talks about his books, plays, and his new chilling novella about a screenwriter. That's Daniel Kalman on Meet the Writers, premiering this Saturday at 1500 London time, and thereafter available as a podcast.
And now to turn our focus to Asia and some of the stories that are making headlines there. Rejoining me in the studio, the former British ambassador to North Korea, among other locations, John Everard. John, when we were talking about the latest rows over North Korea at the start of the programme, we mentioned that all these world leaders are now going to meet up in Hamburg for the G20 summit, that it's obviously going to be a topic of conversation. But one is the alleged bromance between the leaders of the US and China, forged over that rather uncomfortable dinner in Florida, which apparently is finished now.
Well, just about, yes. The bromance forged in Mar-a-Lago, the great chemistry between the two alpha males, as the media loves to call them, is coming to an end, quite clearly. Over the last week, we've seen China and the United States exchange quite barbed words over, hey, what haven't they exchanged barbed words over? Arms sales to Taiwan, $1.4 billion worth of weaponry to Taiwan, standoffs over islands of the South China Sea, trade disputes, Liu Xiaobo, of course, the Nobel Prize winning Chinese dissident whose health is failing. All of these have really stirred the pot. And I think the kind of early blossoming bromance between Donald Trump and Xi Jinping is now well and truly dead, which means that the bilateral meeting between the two presidents to be held in the margins of the G20 summit in Hamburg, which of course has just started amongst a certain amount of tribulation, is going to be very, very difficult for both sides. There are big asks both ways. Xi Jinping in particular has got a lot riding on this, not just in terms of practical outcomes, but he has to look good, he has to look strong. He has the 19th Party Congress coming up this autumn, and he can't afford to allow people to suggest that he's messed up what's called the American account in Chinese politics.
So we've talked about how Donald Trump keeps asking China to take the lead role in North Korea and to intervene, and then that it would seem is going to fall on deaf ears at this summit. But what about bilateral talks with other countries? I mean, he's presumably going to be inside rooms with the leaders of other nations too.
Yes, there will be. It's what you call a diplomacy variable geometry. Everybody meets everybody else in different configurations. And I haven't seen the protocol list, but I would assume that everybody worth their salt at that summit will be knocking on Donald Trump's door demanding a bilateral. The same, of course, goes for Xi Jinping. Everybody wants to talk to the leader of China. And, of course, a lot of Donald Trump's friends and acquaintances are going to be drumming home the same message as Donald Trump will be raising. You've got to do something over North Korea. This really is your problem to solve. I doubt if Xi Jinping is looking forward to the summit.
Also, as you say, it's very important that he goes back to Beijing and is able to say, you know, that he hasn't given in to pressure from America, that he's acquitted himself well at the summit. But all the other leaders are presumably under the same pressure too.
Not quite. I mean, hey, any leader you care to name has got pressures of one kind or another. But the pressures on Xi Jinping right now are particularly intense. The 19th Party Congress we mentioned, things going wrong in the economy, a lot of political instability. The country, remember, has been fighting a battle against corruption, which is only kind of half winning, and which caused a lot of heads to roll and a lot of people to get very angry with what Xi Jinping is doing. So his position is delicate. Donald Trump's position also very delicate for reasons that we discussed endlessly on this program before. The Europeans all have headaches of their own, but none of them are sitting quite so precariously on the fence as those two.
And we talked before about the importance of that relationship between the US and China, but China also, it seems, slightly concerned about the rise of India.
Yes, indeed. And this leads us neatly on to the next article that we wanted to discuss today. About 4 weeks ago now, China started to build a road in what's called the Doklam Plateau. It's one of the two big areas of disputed territory between not India and China, but between Bhutan and China. The Indian-Chinese border was more or less settled some time ago after the 1962 war, effectively. And Bhutan, independent, yes, but firmly within the Indian sphere of influence, has protested what the Chinese are doing. The Indian army, not the Bhutanese, sent troops to stop the Chinese road team from digging any further. They apparently just stood in a line and physically prevented them from getting to where they wanted to build the road. Naturally, the Chinese were very angry. Both sides have now reinforced troops, and we have about 3,000 troops on each side standing off in quite a small area. It must be very tense. The latest twist to this is that the reliably melodramatic Global Times in China has put out a thunderous editorial saying that India must not be allowed to bully small countries like Bhutan, that China must stand up for their rights, and that, you know, India was quite clearly interfering with Chinese activities on sovereign Chinese territory in preventing the road from going ahead. You will remember that not so long ago, this is exactly how China started to flip Nepal. Nepal, not long ago, quite firmly in, you know, a friend of India, now perhaps rather closer to China than it once was. And people are saying that this is what China is trying to do again. And of course, the fact that this editorial emerges just as Prime Minister Modi is going to visit Washington is almost certainly no coincidence.
And so presumably China has been watching the rise of India with some concern.
Yes, China is starting to feel insecure generally, and in particular in its role of regional hegemon, which of course is not a phrase that Chinese would ever use, but that's what it comes down to. China developed very quickly for many years, Chinese growth now slowing, and China now facing all kinds of headwinds and watching with great nervousness as a newly dynamic India, liberalising under Prime Minister Modi, and newly self-assertive, starts to challenge it in all kinds of areas. About 6 months ago, we were sitting in the studio talking about rivalry between China and India in the Indian Ocean. This is just another manifestation of the same.
Let's move on now to the Philippines and another calm and rational statement from Rodrigo Duterte.
That's right, yes. Listeners may remember that about 6 months ago, back in November last year, Abu Sayyaf, the quite brutal Islamist group, kidnapped 6 Vietnamese sailors, and they have just executed 2 of them, presumably because the ransoms demanded weren't paid, and Abu Sayyaf tends to take quite a dim view of non-payments of this kind. Their beheaded bodies were found on the island of Basilan, which is just off Mindanao, so a strongly Muslim area of the Philippines. President Duterte, in his usual statesmanlike formulation, has said that he will eat the Abu Sayyaf militants. He will eat their liver if you provide him with the salt and vinegar. He will eat them in front of them. One hopes he's speaking figuratively.
It's hard to tell, though, isn't it, with Duterte?
It is, yes. I mean, with Duterte, especially when you see his face contorting as he says these things, you have the awkward feeling that if you did indeed serve up liver to him with or without salt and vinegar, he might get his knife and fork out. Not an experiment I want to try, I hasten to add, but there we are. He said this before. There was a bomb in Davao, of course, his home. 6 months ago, where again he threatened to eat the people concerned. Fortunately, there were no subsequent recorded incidents of cannibalism. He didn't actually do it, but he does come out and say these things.
But this is the thing, isn't it? He has marketed himself to the voters as this sort of uber hard man who is going to brook no nonsense from anybody, and if anybody crosses him, he's just going to kill them, and that this is how they're going to end all of their problems, all of the insurrection, all of the violence in the country will be ended by the fact that he's just going to kill anybody who gets in the way. He then has to kind of deliver on that. It's almost a country, you know, any leader who promises security, they don't normally say they're going to eat their opponents.
No, that's right. I mean, Duterte's great contribution to international affairs is he makes Donald Trump look sane.
That should be on his business card.
It should be, actually, yes. But there. And of course, he's particularly frustrated because he ordered his forces in to suppress the Maute rebellion in and around Marawi, the big Muslim-majority city on Mindanao. Back in May? And it all got horribly wrong. 460 dead and counting, 400,000 people, I think it is, now displaced. And despite the best efforts of the Filipino army, the Islamists still holding out in the south of the city. What was supposed to be a quick surgical operation turned out to be much more difficult. So he's learning that simply throwing guns and soldiers at problems doesn't always solve them, and that if you promise quick solutions, you end up looking a bit silly when they don't come about.
Lastly, the Chinese goddesses who flew business class.
That's right. The goddess Matsu, who is the Chinese goddess of the sea and seafarers. You see her gaudy shrines in any Chinese seaport, always with lots and lots of incense burning to her. Chinese sailors take these things very seriously. But she's gone walkabouts. She normally lives in Fujian province in China, but she's doing a cultural tour. She's going through Kuala Lumpur, and then she's going to Malacca and to Singapore. And of course, being a goddess, she flies business class. There are wonderful pictures up on China's social media of this statue sitting in the front row of an aircraft, quite a big statue, over 6 foot apparently, looking rather solemn. Well, statues don't tend to have very good expressions, with sitting in a business class seat, along with the two demons who protect her. So that's an entire business row. It must have cost the organisers quite a bit.
Well, imagine all the other sort of high-flying travellers who got on to find that seat 1A was occupied.
Well, yes, but if you find this
by
a goddess, you can't really complain, can you? And she had an entourage of 130, so that most of the other passengers probably were her entourage anyway, and they probably weren't going to complain very much.
Well, I'd imagine that probably she wouldn't complain about the price of the ticket, because they've probably been covered by somebody else. John, we'll have to leave it there. Thank you very much, John Everard, for joining us this evening. You're listening to Monocle 24. Well, finally, this evening, Couture Week wraps up today in Paris. The annual event attracts some of the industry's biggest names. It was no exception this year. But there were some differences, as Monocle's Jamie Waters found out when he spoke to Daphne Ezard.
We just came out to a men's fashion week, and so it was time for Paris to host this Couture Week, which is always very expected, but who is normally only dedicated to few people and few editors. But this year, out of 36 brands on the schedule, 15 only have the haute couture label distinction. So the main question could be, shall we still call it Couture Week or should we rename it? You know, Couture Week is clearly not what it used to be, but it's probably now the best fashion week to attend or to perform. I'm going to tell you why it changed so much. You know, Couture Week used to be dedicated to extremely elegant and wealthy clients only. There was a time in Paris where a bunch of very rich ladies were coming to Paris, especially for that, to buy some extraordinary, expensive handcraft dresses that cost a fortune and that took ages to make by the most incredible atelier and by the most exceptional artisan couturier. It was a real precious and magic moment, but this period seems to have changed, especially with the arrival of new names who were invited, La Fédération de la Haute Couture et de la Mode, who is normally protecting very well this label, couture, but this time they've invited some ready-to-wear brands, maybe to create a little bit more action modernity in this moment of the year.
Can you tell us a bit about these ready-to-wear brands that we're showing, like Rodarte or some of these other ones? What's kind of special about them? Like, why do you think they were chosen to show during Couture Week?
Yeah, there was a whole lineup of established ready-to-wear names that have appeared on the schedule. So there's, as you said, Proenza Schuller and Rodarte, who are Americans, probably the most exciting brands in New York, but also A.F. van der Voorst or Ronald van der Kemp. I think they decided to come first for the reputation of Paris, because it's probably the most incredible capital, fashion capital, to perform. But also, it's not only a snobbery. There is a real business incentive in this shift. Haute couture coincides with the resort sales period. So resort collections are much more profitable for ready-to-wear designers than the spring-summer and autumn-winter collection, because they have a longest shelf life. So showing in July those ready-to-wear brands is the opportunity to not only show 2 months ahead, but also to deliver to stores earlier. It's a real business compromise that they had to do. Of course, we have to think that some brands like Proinsa Schuller and Rodarte deserting New York will create a big miss, a big void in the American fashion life. People were going in America to see those brands. And now, what will we see when we go to New York? The same question we can ask for London, that not showing much those days. Lots of things are changing in fashion, but they still have some adjustment to be done in the schedules.
Do you think Couture Week, this changed version with all these ready-to-wear brands, do you think it still had the spirit of couture? I mean, with these ready-to-wear brands that were showing Rodarte, Proinsa Schuller, were they, they're sort of showing a more elevated, more craftsmanship in their ready-to-wear than other brands, right? You know, they sort of have a somewhat of a spirit of couture about them, even though they are ready-to-wear brands. Is that fair to say?
Definitely, definitely. You will never see during couture some leggings or joggings or basket, even if a few seasons ago all the couture shows were showing some trainers. But this happened when Christian Dior or Chanel is doing couture. They dare to show some more sporty looks. But for brands who are normally doing ready-to-wear, they're trying to upgrade their collections. So, of course, if you have a look on the Proinsa Schuller show, you will see that the know-how, the ateliers, the know-how were extremely developed. They had their place there. It was not totally crazy to invite them.
Yeah. And final question, what have been your main highlights from the week?
Once again, Proinsa Schuller and Rodarte were a very big moment. It was also the first show of Peter Dundas, the ex-creative director of Pucci and Roberto Cavalli. I don't know if you remember Beyoncé's dress at the Grammy Awards. So that was just a preview of what we've seen at Hôtel de Gèvre last Thursday. So he's launching his eponymous label with the help of his partner and president, Evangelo Buzis. So that was a big moment. Also, Hermès and Miu Miu, they took the opportunity of Couture Week to present their cruise collection. That is also something that we can feel is happening. Hermès performed in the historic shop of 24 Faubourg Saint-Honoré. A Miu Miu show took place at the very masculine and private automobile club. Great choice. Also, Chanel, which is definitely a real maison de couture, moved the Eiffel Tower inside the Grand Palais. They always do some crazy set inside this Grand Palais, but this time they moved the Eiffel Tower, of course.
How very French, yeah.
Yeah, and you have to have a look on Google Images because it's quite impressive. So nothing is impossible with Mr. Lagerfeld, who wanted to pay tribute to the Parisienne. So he moved the Eiffel Tower in the Grand Palais.
And that's Daphne Azar speaking to Monocle's Jamie Waters. And that is it for this Monocle Daily. It was produced by Ben Ryland. Our researchers were Yelling Goffin and Maya Higgard. Our studio manager was Antonio Fernandez. And just to prove this is a programme that remains in fashion to the end, we will bid you farewell this evening with Ella Fitzgerald. I'll be back for tomorrow's Monocle Daily at 2200 here in London. For now, from me, Paul Osborne. Goodbye.
If a custom tailored vet asks me out for something wet, when the vet begins to pet, I cry hooray. But I'm always true to you, darling, in my fashion. Yes, I'm always true to you, darling.